upgrade your tool storage for the new year with help from Menards. For heavy-duty storage that protects your tools, choose MasterForce. From shelving units to cabinets and so much more, you can keep your tools safe and within reach. Get versatile and durable storage from MasterForce today. Check out all our MasterForce storage in-store or check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Failed you. Welcome to the Village Oak Tree Stories and Poetry. I'm Terrence O'Donnell, your scholar, back with more stories and poems from authors around the world. I know it's been a couple of weeks since I've read any stories of poetry, but I've been busy lately with other projects outside of media, or podcasting in general, if you want to get to that. If you're listening to this on WAA Radio, you know that they have been running older shows while I've been on a break. As I mentioned on my last show a couple of weeks ago, this is how things will be this year. I've got other projects I got going on. So for today's show, I have another episode of The Gravediggers of Orpheus, Chapter 12. A dystopian future story, and the first chapter of a new fantasy from a Medium writer. I will save chapter 2 for the next time I read stories for everyone, plus two poems that I think people will like. So gather around once more and let me read to you under the shade of the village oak tree. As I said, my first story is picking up where we were last time, The Gravediggers of Orpheus. This one's chapter 12 by Catherine Elaine. Their shabby gravedigger uniforms were perfect for the setting. Captain Barrick and Joe blended with the usual crowd of the bar perfectly. The place was trash. A lousy bar at the very periphery of the civilized regions of Orpheus. Beyond the nearby hills was an open war zone almost completely covered by the red mist known as the Rebel Territory. The government made everyone believe that there was nothing but parasite-infested ruins on the other side. Though the rumors suggested the rebel forces were rebuilding cities and growing in numbers. Derek and Joe sat by the bar sipping cheap whiskey. Joe small talk with the android bartender. Their man wasn't there yet, but he would arrive shortly. He was one of the regulars, and the bartender claimed to know him well. Derek felt uneasy all the while, though. Everything appeared fine. The few customers were drinking in corners, minding their own business. The old-fashioned television murmured in the background behind the bartender's back, showing rows of faces unknown to Derek. "Well, it's a darn shame, ain't it?" said Joe after taking a swig. "What the dispatch said?" Derek nodded. He knew they must get rid of the old Vulture 05, his home for the last 10 years. And with it, their gravedigger days would be over. No ship meant no grave-digging missions. Not that it mattered. If the government had labeled them as rebels, their future was determined, a life of running and hiding. But first they had to get the illegal fuel to fly away and find Doc Liz's friends who might eliminate the microchip in Sophie's head. Also, the wounded Morbillard Aki wasn't stable enough to be moved. No, they couldn't give Vulture away, not yet. Derek clutched his half-empty glass. Something wasn't right. Every cell in his brain sensed the danger lurking nearby. Derek took a sip, but spat it out the very next second because he saw his face on the television. The official government channel showed the faces of rebel forces around the clock, wanted dead or alive. "Cap, get out! Get out now!" Jimmy yelled in the transmitter, attached near Derek's ear. Joe heard it too. Both jumped up and ran to the exit. The moment both got out, Derek saw the ghoul ship approaching from afar with some of the ghoul officers running their way. Gunshots filled the air. "Jimmy, fire the engines and fly," Derek yelled. Jimmy didn't answer. Derek and Joe ran, hiding behind large rocks. Though armed, they didn't dare shoot back at so many. Derek saw a strange determination in Joe's eyes. "Go, Cap," he whispered, with sweat dripping down his forehead. "No, no, Joe." Before he knew it, Joe jumped from behind the rock, firing back at the ghouls, so his captain would have time to escape. Derek nearly joined him. He would never leave one of his men to die, no matter how noble the cause. But somebody from behind the rocks grabbed Derek by the hand and pulled him onward, simultaneously shooting at the ghouls. It was Sophie. Derek was too stunned to ask anything. Her usually soft features appeared sharp, almost robotic-like. Her every shot hit the target. She was a petite killing machine, wearing a Gravedigger uniform. Sophie shot the ghoul officers nearing Joe, while he limped to his captain and collapsed. Nobody said a word. Derek picked him up and ran to the vulture while Sophie covered them. She never missed a single ghoul she shot at. The door of the vulture swooshed open for them to jump in. Vulture took off into the red mist beyond the hills, though their flight would not last long because of the fuel shortage. Never had a patient sticking a gun in my face and a baby in my hands before. You live and you learn, Doc Liz murmured angrily while examining Joe's state. The medbots hovered around, taking his vitals. What do you think you were doing? This was the first time Derek had ever raised his voice addressing a woman. He yelled in Sophie's face. Both stood in the corridor, still trying to catch their breaths after escaping into the ship. Saving your lives, you idiot, she yelled back. There's nothing left to save here, said Doc Liz. Joe's dead. My next story is from the Substack channel. Here's a Substack page called Vindicators, entitled Steel People by Ken W. I woke up alone on the beach, masked in clouds of spray. When I sat up, the rising tide hit me in the face like a frozen sheet. I snatched my leather back off the sand where I'd been using it as a pillow and ran up the beach into the dunes. In the darkness, I tripped on riftwood and strands of plastic. I found her at the top of a dune with a little driftwood fire sputtering and her pale skin aglow in its weak light. A blanket was around her bare shoulders and her bushy hair fluttered in the breeze. When she saw me, she threw it sideways into the sand and scooted over. You should have woken me before heading for high ground, I said, and sat beside her. She shrugged. You don't sleep much, and I wanted to leave you. That part was true. I didn't like closing my eyes, because that brought back memories from better times. I crossed my legs and leaned on her shoulder. So, yes, she said, and raised a dark, thin eyebrow. Think we'll see turtles this year? I twisted to look up in the sky. The glitter band still shined. I remember hearing from someone that it would be a few years until most of the satellites started running out of power. We saw them last year, I know, but we hadn't seen them the year before that, I said. You worry too much, she said. She jabbed a thumb into her chest. I think they'll be there. I think we've finally gotten past the worst years. I didn't share her optimism. Maybe I'll have grown up in what we used to call a driftwater community. She was used to living the way our ancestors a millennia ago did, worrying one season ahead. I'd come from a skyscraper somewhere that no longer existed. I'd seen humanity lose everything. Want to try sleeping more while the fire's still going? She said with pride at her flickering blaze of damp twigs. Of course. Thank you for the fire. It's lovely, I said. We lay back and fell asleep with the sand warming our backs and our bare bodies pressed together, arms entwined to warm our fronts. The next morning, the ruined Dallas skyline poked from the mist. I paused from packing up camp, counted the great arcologies. 7. Missing one, I counted again. One of the big towers must have fallen over last night, I said and pointed. She counted 2. We didn't hear it. I always missed the steel people buildings falling over. I wanted to watch one go. She kicked sand in frustration, and the wind blew it back on us. I smirked at her, for I'd seen many buildings collapse, and she'd always missed the great ancient towers toppling, shedding debris as they went for one reason or another. She aimed her next sand kick at me. We ate our last bits of hog jerky for breakfast. Then we headed off up the Caribbean coast. We wore our belongings around our waist and belts, and over our shoulders in a poncho and leather backpack. Humidity was seething, and perspiration had condensed in our bodies in seconds. We each carried a spear in one hand and held each other with the other, our fingers intertwined, rubbing salt into each other. The Dallas Metro coast unfolded before us. Empty shells of houses sank into the newfound water. How loud was this all when it was alive, Maybelle said. I wanted to tell her I was from a completely different city called Boston, and cities up there were older, colder, and far more compact. Except she'd scowl and say...
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner. so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
The steel people worried about things that didn't matter. I said very loud. There were cars roaring all day and night. The only break was when the smog came in and muffled everything. The sky turned black. I know what smog looks like, she said. Tell me about something prettier. At night, all the shop signs glowed neon red and blue and pink in the sky. You could see all those logos dancing in the sky, I said. I looked back at her and saw a little smile. It was so beautiful. Around noon, we came upon a herd of seals resting on the beach. The plastic was piled high around the edges of their territory. As we stalked them, I wondered who'd gone through the trouble of doing all that work to protect the seals, until I saw a large bull grab a car fender and haul it into the pile. We picked out a young female with no calf in sight. Then we jumped her. The pack hauled themselves hooting into the water, but I sprinted faster. I killed her. We dragged her corpse far from the seal beach as we could and spent the afternoon prepping her. That night we had nice, blubbery seal meat. Maybelle left as much fat as she could on. Fat's good for energy, she said. I didn't question her. I was just glad to have a full meal in my belly and weighing me down for the first time in weeks. As we cooked, the air grew hotter and wetter until it was a seething soup. The act of lifting brown seal meat to my lips generated perspiration on my arms. I looked over my shoulder. The Dallas skyline was dark finements against the deepest black well of storm clouds. They drove specks of flocking birds and fronds of plastic refuse before them on a flowing cloud like a bride's dress fluttering around her feet. I looked at Maybelle and reached out an arm. She surprised me by throwing both her arms around me and burying her head on my shoulder. Her bushy blonde hair tickled my chin and made my nose itch as I kissed her greasy scalp. We found a solid stone wall and hunkered down. We stretched our lone blanket like a tarp and weighed it down with the heaviest rocks we could find. I dug a hole just outside and shoved our rain catcher in, then checked the filter. All good. I crawled inside our little nap hole. She unfurled her arms and entangled me. There was only darkness, sweat, and our slickly wet bodies sticking together. We heard it first. The ground shook and groaned around us. A few insects fled across my back and up out the exit. Fools, I thought. The wind whipped them away. It blew the tarp in until it was concave and taut. Rain pounded the outside. Abandoned buildings groaned, but over it all came a deep, agonized roar. It rose to a painful howl and fell to a dying animal's moan as the tarp went slack. Then it rose to a howl again and screamed louder and louder. Water trickled under the tip and ran in two streams, one over my shoulder blades and onto my back, one over my breast and down to my belly. I shivered and hugged Maybelle close. Sure, any moment would end our lives in a wall of water and terror. I hoped it would be too quick to feel. And I felt her tremble and hug me tighter. That feeling of someone clutching me tight as I was holding her, relying on me to protect them, it stoked a warmth within me. Whatever happens, I'm grateful to spend the end days with you, I whispered in her ear. I'm sure she couldn't hear me. My words crushed into the back of our little safe hole. Yet she must have felt my lips moving and understood. She dug her fingernails into my back and gnawed into my chest. The tarp ripped open and water vapor sprayed us. I hugged her tighter and twisted to take the cold shower. She shook her head. We suffered together. It went on for hours. Hurricanes had an eye, even the modern Titano storms. We must have missed it because it never stopped. At some point, I felt Maybelle let out a long snore into my shoulder. I was horribly, destructively envious. Until a high-pitched scream raced overhead. She shot awake and dug fingernail furrows into my chest. "It's me," I gasped in pain. She stopped and then hugged me and stroked my bleeding shoulders as the screaming continued. "I'm sorry," she said. Then she cocked her head up. "What is it?" It howled right overhead until punctuated by a brief blast that shook the ground. I knew the sound of a scramjet. They always blew high over the city, screaming so loud we had to halt school until they stopped. "There goes someone important," Father always said with a genuine delight. "A jet. One of the steel people's flying machines," I said. "Why is it out here in a storm?" she screamed back so I could hear. I shrugged hard as I could. My shoulders ached and I flinched. "Sorry," she said, and kissed me with salty lips. As she did that, the winds died off into a gentle hum. We held together, locked eternally, as trailing blasts of wind blew. We fell asleep soon as the gaps were long enough. I woke cold and wet, with a finger poking my chin. Damon, Maybell said. I opened my eyes and a white light blinded me. Ugh, I said as I clamped my hands over my eyes. It's just the sun, silly. We survived, and we've got a full water catcher. She poked me down to my chest and pressed her palm over my sluggish heart. I crawled out and splattered into a puddle of mud. I came up in a crouch and breathed in cold, fresh air. The sky was pale gray, and a faint film of rain covered us all. The hurricane had blown away all the smog and left fresh, virgin coolness on the morning breeze. It kissed my skin all over and gave me the strength to stand. I could clearly see the jagged ruins of slow-sinking high-rises all around. The gulf itself had risen by several feet, so all the dunes we trekked across 2 days ago were little islands as trash gathered around them like reeds in my fingers. It was such a sweet morning. I fished a brush from my leatherback, the tiny bit of soap we'd borrowed once so long ago, and started scrubbing. Maybell emerged and did the same. She stretched out each tress of her hair and brushed the grime from it. "Where's the rain catcher?" I said. "I changed the filter, put it up there," she pointed, "at the top of the stone wall. It sat there, pristine and beading sweat like one of us. 6 liters of clear drinking water, free of dirt and pollution." I got thirsty looking at it. "I was going to fill up all our bottles, but remembered how scared you were when I left you sleeping alone," she said. I took her cheek and kissed it. "Thank you, my doomsday companion." "Stop calling it doomsday," she said. She plucked her water bottles from her pack. "It is. I saw the floodgates of Boston collapse. Even if there's still my fellow steel people out there, I know it's all over," I said. "For you, maybe," she said. "For me, it's another day." I shivered at how easily the fall of human civilization could be brushed off. I watched her fill her bottles, then handed mine over. Yet, I was jealous of her for not knowing more. Then she took my shoulder and gave me an apology with a wide-eyed stare I felt myself falling into. "Any nightmares?" she said. "No, the storm must have blown them away," I said. "Me old mom said the storm winds blow away all our evil spirits. That's why the waters send them whenever it gets too humid," she said with a toothy grin. "Now, if you've got nothing else to do, we need to find that jet. Maybe it's full of goodies for us." "Yeah, let's do that," I said. I shivered. I didn't want to see the luxuries of civilization. Even now, they reached out to me for a society I could return to, one pumping full of fresh water and ready farm food. Mabel saw I was afraid, so she insisted we wear armor. Without a scrap of body armor, we found a patch of pure mud smelling like clean earth and smeared ourselves head to toe in gooey blackness. I felt silly at first as we covered each other, and I took care of painting around her eyes and nose. Yet I worked away at her back, and she got mine. So she so thoroughly covered me that I began to believe and covered her just as thoroughly. When it was done, we were pitch black and Sheila from whatever my fears were. We hefted our spears, and I extended an arm. Maybell locked us back together, finger to finger. Finding the crash site was easy, as scaling the highest hill and looking around till we saw fresh, shiny metal amongst the weathered ruins. It sat right on the shoreline, nose pointed towards the surf. It was a millisecond of flight time away from being lost forever. Best of all, nothing was moving. We communicated by hand squeezes. I counted to three, and we leapt down together, landing with a combined grunt. She gave a single squeeze to tell me she was okay, and I led us away. The debris narrowed the street until I brushed my shoulders on either side, so I went first. I kept my spear pointed ahead and tucked under my left arm, while my right arm was held behind me to maintain my link with her. We emerged onto the beach. The acidic stench of burnt plastic and electronics reached my nostrils. I wrinkled my nose and pressed forward. "Ugh, the smell of evil," Mabel said. "Close enough," I thought. We circled the wreck, dipping our heels in the warm water. The ship was a luxury skimmer. It had a sharp nose like a fox's and sleek body. 2 short, rigid wings extended out its sides to engine pots, except one wing had folded beneath the wreck. The other stuck into the air, its engine leaking dark oil into the ground. The cockpit was polarized, so we couldn't see within. I grabbed my other best tool from my pack, a crowbar. The heat-resistant paint had peeled around my hands and the tip. The cockpit had been jarred loose, and there were plenty of gaps. I jammed the crowbar in and grabbed the end. Maybell came in and planted her hands in her mine. We threw our bodies into it. The cockpit groaned. then released its cargo with a final crack and a jolt that threw us down into the sand. Maybell leapt up first. By the time I was up, she had her spear aimed at the cockpit. The pilot wore a neon orange flight suit. She was slumped in her seat, brown blood dried around her eyes and nose. Already I could see her face purpling and smell the rot in her. I studied her suit and the writing. Where was she from? Where was there still civilization that hadn't been consumed by Earth's fury? The medicine bag should be behind her seat, Mabel said, and climbed inside. The cockpit was barely big enough for two people, but she went in head first and contorted herself around the seats. Couldn't help but grin at her long limbs sticking around to shove herself into the confines. Here we go. Her triumphant grin blazed bright as she yanked the red bag free. There should be emergency rations, too, I said. I planted a foot on the empty cockpit's chair and leaned over the dashboard. I tried the navigation computer. It was splotchy with busted diodes, but I clearly saw the outlines of the Mississippi River and the northern states. I felt frizzy hair tickle my shoulder. I shivered. Do you miss home? She said. Maybe, I said. It's okay, she said. Then she clambered up past me. I couldn't find any food. I felt around under the dashboard until the glove compartment popped free. Two black bunders came out, and I snatched them up. There, emergency dried food. It's not quite seal meat, but, I said. If we're hungry enough, it'll be good, she said. She perched on the edge of the dashboard, her sandals bending beneath her feet as she expertly held her balance. Is that all we can get? Yes, I said. We should bury her. Her soul is just sitting there alone, Mabel said. I looked from the dead pilot to the gray sky. I wondered if someone had set out to find the lost ship. The pilot had a few worry lines around her cheeks. Her brow was obscured by the visor and virtual reality view set of her helmet. Her mouth was slack, as though she'd gone down impassively trying to right her craft and clear the hurricane to the very end. Let's do something quick, I said. We buried her in a car debris and shoved a smashed landing strut straight down at the headspace. Mabel locked us together again. We bowed her head. She muttered something on her breath. I waited until we were on our way, fresh supplies and barter bait bouncing along our backs before breaking the solemn silence. Mabel, what did you say to her? I said. I just asked her not to be stupid anymore and fly into storms, Mabel said in a soft, completely serious tone. I nodded back. Simple and understandable. We headed along the shore until it rose along the bones of a concrete building into a steep cliff. We clambered to the top and were stunned by the brightness of the yellow rays. Wow, I said. I stopped us short and wheeled around to look at the noon light. Dallas towers were child's fingers reaching up to shield their eyes from the light. The city around them, a mess of smashed melons and running water. I was suddenly incredibly tired, so I sat down. Mabel sat down with me and clutched my hand into her lap. I found myself cold and shivering as I huddled up next to her. It was beautiful. The curve of her body hunched over, chin craned to survey the doomed plains, was beautiful. We'll stay on this side of Dallas and go straight up. We can track the river until it leaves the city behind, right? Mabel said. Yeah, definitely. The water will get pure after we pass it, I said. There should be at least one tribe out there. Maybe there'll be a river talker, Mabel said and looked at me sharply. I looked back at her butterscotch brown eyes. She didn't know what butterscotch was. I closed my eyes. I knew why the pilot had flown into a hurricane. Someone had ordered her to. I knew what they'd do if she refused. Is the river talker for the dead pilot? I said. No, I want one to marry us so our souls can be bound together forever, she said. She leaned back and waited, worriedly, for me to come to her. Yes, I said, and came running. I don't ever want to return to whatever's left of the Steel Peoples. I want to be with you forever. I shivered harder as I severed all my last doubts. She kissed me with wet, salty lips. I caught her cheeks and kissed her back just as hard. Her fingers gripped the sensitive insides of my elbows until my arms twitched. Beads of perspiration ran down my skin under my poncho, sending rivulets of mud trickling down to pool at the creases of my elbows and at my waist. A building somewhere in the distance groaned and imploded with a roar. Mabel kissed me harder. What a perfect place to be, I thought. So, before I get into the other stories, let me read a little advertisement here. This week, I'm going to promote WAA Radio. And so I want to invite everyone to listen to the Village Oak Tree Stories and Poetry. It may or may not be coming on again at Monday night at 11 p.m. Eastern Time at Reese Across America Radio. They said something about, because I was doing a name change here, that they may put it on a different time frame. So we'll have to wait and see what they do. You know, at this point, let them do what they want. It's, you know, I'll give it to them free of charge. So search out www.reeseacrossamerica.org/radio by typing in the word Reese in these mobile apps, iHeartRadio, Odyssey, or TuneIn, or find them on a web browser to listen to the show and support WAA Radio. That's Whiskey Alpha Alpha Radio for anybody who understands phonetic alphabet. Reese Across America is a nonprofit radio station in Portland, Maine, USA, that supports veterans programs and organizations. By tuning in, you're helping to support veterans across the U.S. So search them out, enjoy the shows they have to offer, and thank a veteran while you're at it, no matter where you are in the world, because veterans are veterans everywhere in every country, and not just in the United States. Now, my third story this week is called Cast into Darkness, Leora's Story, Act 1. This is written by Mitch, but he had a bunch of help with some editors on a publication called Blue Pencils. There was no time to think, no time to even scream. The world shrank to the pounding of her heartbeat, the rush of blood in her ears, and the sight of Ulrich's grimy fingers outstretched, reaching. Yara knelt in a patch of wild thyme that clung to the chalky earth beneath the forest canopy. She let her fingers drift through the delicate, fragrant leaves, feeling their soft resistance. A tiny purple flower caught her attention, and she plucked it, the scent rising to greet her, familiar and bittersweet. It filled her head and cleared her mind. Tendrils of loose brown hair fell around her face, brushing her cheeks and tangling around her neck as she dragged her half-filled basket closer. She hated having used that heavy old thing, but it was sturdy and strong, even if it made her shoulders ache to carry it in the forest. Perhaps she would ask her father to make her a lighter one when he came back. If he ever came back. The thought surfaced unbidden, stealing Leora's breath. She gasped at the weight of it. He had to come back. The war would end soon. It had to. He was strong, a good fighter. He would return. She knew he would. She began to collect more of the herb. The familiar routine relaxed her aching shoulders. Here, among the grasses and the trees, it was always the same. The solitude, the peace, the slow rhythm of her own breaths. This was her sanctuary, her refuge from the noise of the village. Her thoughts continued to drift to the meals she would prepare, onions sizzling in butter until they turned a rich golden brown, their aroma filling the air and mingling with the earthy scent of the thyme she had just picked. The herbs would crackle and release their oils, the savory perfume mixing with the buttery sweetness. Maybe a bit of lamb to make a hearty stew. Mother would love that. She always did. The thought of the lamb, tender and rich, simmering in the pot, made her mouth water. Once she gathered in the thyme, she'd look for rosemary, its sharp smell already seeping into her thoughts. No one should have been this far into the woods, not here where sunlight filtered through the trees and silence hung like a gentle curtain. That was what made the sudden sharp crack of a branch behind her so startling. Leora shot to her feet, her basket clutching against her chest, her shoulders aching from its weight as she spun around. A man made his way through the trees toward her. He was tall, stooped, and moved with an unnerving familiarity. Recognition crawled up her spine. Ulrich, she said, her voice tight. The name tasted bitter, like ash in her mouth. Greasy hair clung to his forehead, and a grin that was more grimace than a smile twisted his lips. Now, what have we here, eh? Is it little Leora, so far from home? His voice sounded kind, but she heard the malice oozing between the words. What's a girl like you doing so far away from anyone? His grin widened, revealing stained teeth, already blackening at their roots. She took an involuntary step back. The heavy slats of the basket dug into her ribs. I'm collecting herbs, Ulrich, for cooking. Her voice trailed off as he took another step closer. His eyes glinted, hungry, not for food, but for something darker. She'd seen that look before, in other places, on other men. It was a craving that had been left unattended for too long until twisted into cruelty. "Surely, little bird, you must be lost, so far away and all by yourself. Let me help you." Ulrich wiped his hands on his stained trousers, smearing streaks of dirt across the fabric. Leora straightened, her shoulders stiffening despite the quiver in her knees. "I don't need help, Ulrich. I was just leaving. Mother will be expecting me." The quiver betrayed her, and she hated it, hated the fear that crept into her voice. "Mother, is it?" His voice dripped with false concern, the mockery clear. "Does she know where you are, little bird? I bet she'd worry if she knew. But she doesn't, does she?" He took another step, his hands reaching, fingers curling and uncurling. "It's dangerous out here. Does anyone know where you are?" And then he lunged. There was no time to think, no time to even scream. The world shrank to the pounding of her heartbeat, the rush of blood in her ears, and the sight of Ulrich's grimy fingers outstretched, reaching. She twisted, her body moving before her mind caught up. His mouth curved into a cruel smile. He was close, too close. His hands gripped her shoulders. Filthy fingernails bit through the thin fabric of her blouse and raked painful welts across her skin. But instead of the icy rush of fear, Leora felt a different heat surge through her. It was fiery red and hot. Rage filled her veins and burned away her fear. She could hear her heartbeat slamming in her chest like a trapped bird. How dare he? How dare this vile, wretched man think he could hurt her? The forest seemed to pause, to hold its breath. The trees leaned in closer. She could almost hear them. They spoke words without meaning, whispers in the leaves. Tingles worked their way up into her shoes. "Stand," the trees said. Somehow she could sense their slow strength, their will to endure. It was old and quiet and would not be moved, not by anything men could ever do. Closer the trees leaned, their voices filled her ears. She felt the roots clawing into the earth, drawing strength from deep below. "Stand!" Without thinking, Leora swung her heavy old basket, her muscles strained as she put every ounce of herself into the motion. The basket connected with Ulrich's chin with a dull, bone-jarring thump that reverberated up her arm. His eyes widened in shock. His expression froze in disbelief as he staggered back. His hands flew to his face as the wood shattered into splinters. Blood, hot and red, burst from his nose, spattered down his rough beard threaded with gray. She watched fat drops catch the dappled light and fall like shards of ruby crimson against the dark earth. There was no time to think. She dropped the ruins of what was left and ran, her feet pounding over the wild thyme, crushing the purple flowers beneath her heels. The forest blurred around her as she pushed herself faster and further away. Behind her, Ulrich's voice rose, broken and distant, swallowed by the wind and the whispering trees. "Come back, little bird. I only wanted to help." Then he laughed. It was mocking and cruel and grated against her ears. She didn't look back. So that's, and like I said, next time I read stories and poems for you guys, I'll read the second chapter. Now I have a couple of poems for you. This is a story. It's kind of makes you think a little bit. It's entitled "I Am," an "I Am" poem, she says, by Zilin Sam from Singapore. And this is published in Catharsis Chronicles. "I am the burning light of my truest self. I manipulate the sacred energy of the earth. I bloom like the trumpet of an angel. I am protected by powerful ancient magic. I let my emotions flow like a sparkling river. I feed the essence of my soul. I ground myself on the enchanted forest floor. I manifest my dreams and deepest desires. I remove the cloak of my self-limiting beliefs. I peel off my burdens and watch them burn. I am embraced in the arms of the universe. I make my inner child feel safe. I transform and craft my own reality. I stop defining myself with social labels. I erase past wounds and cut cords that no longer serve me. I learn to say no without the guilt. I am secure in the sanctuary of my mortal body. I leave the past versions of myself to die in the shadows. I communicate with my guardian angels every day. I put myself first after a lifetime of self-neglect. I believe in the magic that flows within me. I let the stars guide me to the missing parts of my soul. I feel safe in the rush of the cosmic flow. I admire and love the spirit that lives within me. I love the reflection that used to bother me. I use my words as a voice to inspire others. I have a deep purpose for existence. I comfort my wounded soul with tender love and compassion. I live in the here and now. I welcome the gifts from the universe with open arms. I am that I am. My last poem is entitled Bittersweet as Darkest Chocolate, My Heart Beats Wild by Mariana Balsarova from Bulgaria, published in the Good Vibes Club. The night enfolds my shadow's fleeting line. The stars begin their passionate ballet. In silver dust they scatter on their way and crown this sinful world with lights divine. My shoes I carry softly in my hand and wander through dimensions wide and vast. The night's a shadow trailing close and fast. Its steps my own as if by fate they're planned. I breathe the darkness deeply every time and taste a fleeting moment on my lips. To live right here, right now, I take the risks. My heart beats wild, alive, in its own rhyme. I spin and twirl beneath the starlit dome. My bare heels tap a rhythm on the ground. The world's a fairy tale where I am bound, a weird silhouette looking for a home. I melt into the night without a trace. This bitter sweetness lingers in my veins. And secretly, I'll steal through cosmic planes, a fragment of a star's glorious grace. So thank you for joining me today. I appreciate you listening in here. And I'll be back here maybe in a week or two. I don't mention it's going to be next week because I'm working. I'm doing a bunch of work and it's Thanksgiving. But maybe in a couple of weeks I'll have some more stories for you and find some more poems. So with that, I'll talk to you later. Slantje. Guru Mahagat, thank you for listening to the show today. I hope you enjoyed the variety of stories and poems again this week. If you like the show, please like, subscribe, and reply, as this goes a long way towards reaching more listeners around the world. As a Shanké, I hope you'll allow me to continue delighting you with a story or poem here under the crown of Biha. Maybe they will bring you a smile, take you away from your troubles for a time. As I say goodbye this week, I wish to leave you with this Irish blessing as you go about your day. May your path rise up to meet you, and the sun warm your bonnet as you walk down the lane to the pub. May your friends and relations bring you a pint after you retell these stories and poems I give you here. Slán go fóill. Goodbye for now.